internet tonight, which I think qualifies as one of these pressing issues of public policy and regulation. And I want to frame this by starting to talk to you about the internet as a pluripotent network. And I use that term advisedly, although my biologist friends will tell me I'm doing violence to the term. Pluripotent in the sense that it's the network that can be any network. It's the network that can do anything that we can imagine on it. At least that's the status quo today. So this is in contrast to the networks that preceded it, the phone network, the so-called smart networks, in which services were deployed from the middle. So, for example, if you invented a nifty feature like something that would let you see who was calling you before you picked up the phone, we call it caller ID, that service would be presented to the phone company as an idea. The phone company would turn it into a product. That product would be rolled out to users based on whether or not they thought it would maximize their revenues. And as a result, the phone network was historically a network of very slow innovation and one that was characterized by an extreme culture of management and stewardship, it must be said, for good and for ill. Contrast that with the dumb network, the internet, the pluripotent network. Some years ago in Geneva, a British scientist who was working at CERN, the High Energy Research Lab, named Tim Berners-Lee, had an idea for sharing documents with other physicists. So he wrote a little browser tool that would let you look at these documents, and he wrote a little server tool that would let you share these documents, and he wrote a little markup language that would let you prepare the documents, and he sent it to his colleagues at other research institutions and academic institutions and private industry. And they chose or didn't choose, as was their own bent, to implement this, to run these servers. And that was it. It was the web. That was all it took. Someone had an idea. They communicated with their colleagues about, and their colleagues judged that idea to be good, and that idea grew. No one had to provision a network for the World Wide Web. No one had to ask permission from a network operator for the World Wide Web. We just got the web. And the fact that the web was immensely disruptive to the people who operated the network didn't enter into the calculus at all. Tim Berners-Lee didn't have to make a business case to the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union. Didn't have to make a business case to Bell Canada or the Swisstel company. All he had to do was develop his technology, stick it on the web. And we've seen that story repeated again and again, whether it's Skype putting long-distance carriers out of business, or Napster doing such creating such upheaval in the music industry, always without permission, always with the authority devolved to the network's edge. Now, this exceeded the wildest dreams of even the most techno-visionary among us. So one of my favorite examples of U.S.-Canadian diplomatic or cultural exchange is my friend and colleague William Gibson, an American draft dodger who now lives here in Canada. He's considered, I think, one of the world's greatest science fiction writers, certainly one of the greatest living ones, and maybe one of the greatest of all times. He's one of his claims to fame is of having coined the term cyberspace. And Bill, in 1984, coined the rallying cry, "The street finds its own uses for things." And he imagined a dark future in which technology was primarily deployed by large Zaibatsu-style corporate entities that would use it to do a kind of top-down broadcast communication in which the people at the center of the network would decide what the people at the edges of the network would see and would transmit it to them. And indeed, in his world, it became this entertainment mode of communication became so powerful that we actually started to experience the sensorium of actors. Actors would have something that would latch into their brainstem, deliver their sensory experiences to us through a comparable jack in our own brainstem. And funnily enough, Bill classifies this as an optimistic vision of the future because, as he said, at least the cities weren't all radioactive ash. This was, of course, written in 1984. But still, it must be remembered that Gibson, who is indeed someone who is a keen observer of the present and predictor of the future, still predicted a world in which networks would primarily be used in this broadcast configuration. And imagine that the primary innovations would come from relaying entertainment products to one another. So what had the pluripotent Dumb Network deliver instead of this? Because, of course, this was a vision that was shared by many people in industry in that period and in the years that followed. You may remember the enormous investment in this country and in others in asynchronous transfer mode, or ATM networks, which were primarily designed to deliver video on demand, essentially, to create a kind of glorified cable network for the people who would use it. What did it deliver instead? Well, it delivered progressively lower kinds of lower resolution and lower quality reproduction. You can think of the trajectory of the voice call to get an understanding of this. The first generation of the voice call being a controlled handset, that big light black Bell handset that you may remember from your childhood if you're old enough, connected to a single network operated by a single carrier that was a quasi-governmental entity or fully governmental entity that was charged with guaranteeing the quality of that voice conversation from one end to the next. The phones themselves were built like tanks. And then came a couple of landmark decisions, one of them being Carter Phone in the United States, that established that the phone company could not dictate what kind of equipment you could plug into the wall. And this ushered in, along with the growth of the electronics industry in the Asia-Pacific Rim, a golden age of novelty phones shaped like hamburgers and footballs. And the quality of the phone call plunged, while your ability to express yourself through your accessorizing of your phone network grew. The quality of the phone call continued to fall because we went from the novelty football phone to the 900 megahertz cordless phone, infamous, of course, for letting you hear what your neighbors were talking about on their 900 megahertz cordless phone. And from there to the mobile phone, we all know the Can You Hear Me Now advertising campaigns, in which mobile companies actually advertise how bad their phone call quality can be as a selling point. And now we have the mobile phone and the calling card as a means of beating the long-distance tariffs, which further lower that call. If you've ever taken a long-distance call through a calling card, it's how I do all my calling these days. My British mobile phone bill has dropped from £500 a month to £5 a month thanks to my use of calling cards, but it does sound like you're talking through a bowl of Rice Krispies most of the time. And now we have Skype, and Skype not only sounds like it's taking place through a bowl of Rice Krispies, but every now and again the Terminator weighs in with a kind of style of interference. What we've done in the era of the Dumb Network, and forevermore, I think, is traded quality and reliability for price, access, and customizability. As much as we enjoy robots throwing buildings at each other and the other marvels of the entertainment industry, when we're given a choice, we vote copiously with our time and wallet for each other. Not to watch robots, but to talk to one another. This is why the telecoms industry is 100 times larger than the entertainment industry. That content isn't king, conversation is. All content is a thing that we talk about. If I sent you to a desert island and gave you a choice of taking your records or your friends, and you chose the records, we'd call you a sociopath. So, the broadcaster's vision of a one-to-many future is properly regarded as a deeply parochial vision, one in which the imaginer, that entertainment executive, finds himself forevermore at the center of the future of the information economy. And as such, this shouldn't surprise us, because every industrialist, after all, has considered him and his industry at the center of the future of the country that he resides in. What's good for GM is good for America, and so on. Today we have the financial services industry explaining how converting savings to investment is something that should consume 95% of the economy, and 70% of the money that rolls through it should be turned into bonuses. But these propositions about the role of entertainment product in the future of human endeavor have historically been testable by time and by region, in which every market and circumstance was able to determine locally how best to conduct its information policy. So, of course, in Canada, we have this massive investment in public broadcasting and public media through things like the CBC and the National Film Board. We have landmark trade decisions over split-run magazines. And those of you who are Americans in the audience should buttonhole a Canadian and have them explain just how weird our split-run magazine policy is and how fraught it's been over the years. We have Francophone media and public subsidy for Francophone media. We have compulsories on pharmaceuticals and on U.S. broadcast signals. All of these are sui generis. They are uniquely Canadian in their mix and in their deployment constantly in flux, but nevertheless a genuinely Canadian answer to the question of how best to conduct information policy. And in the U.S., you've had a completely different set of solutions. For example, the first 100 years of American existence were its pirate century, during which no foreign copyright or patent was given any protection within the U.S., giving rise to the appellation Yankee, which comes from a Dutch word meaning pirate. The Dutch, of course, were upset that having stolen the secret of bone china from the Chinese, they found Americans making their own bone china without paying royalties to the Dutch. This is another motif in information policy, that every pirate wants to be an admiral, and every pirate considers what he did to be an act of progress and what happens afterwards to be an act of theft. So in the U.S. history, you have its pirate century. You have a regime that doesn't acknowledge the notion of a moral right for an author. So once an author sells her painting to you, you can deface the painting, and the author doesn't have any say. This is in contrast to the continental regime, which I'll get to in a moment. There's no notion of a lending right. So here in Canada, when libraries lend books, money is paid into a pool that's then given out to Canadian authors for the right to have lent the book. In America, the free libraries, such as they are, unfortunately, you may have seen the news that Philadelphia's free library system, the one that Benjamin Franklin founded, is being shuttered as of October 2nd. But libraries in the U.S. don't pay a lending right. There's no private copying levy in the U.S., or at least not as conceived of here in Canada or in some European countries. So, for example, there's no levy on blank VHS cassettes or on many CDs, although you can, in fact, buy a levy-paid CD in the United States, blank CD in the United States. But there are things like compulsory licenses on sound recording, so that anyone who wants to record any composition can do so, provided they pay a fixed fee. So when Sid Vicious wanted to record My Way, Paul Anka didn't get to say no. Sid Vicious just put some money in, and he could lay down that track on his LP. Contrast that, say, with Scandinavia, where you have a very strong moral right, a moral right that knows no exception. And Scandinavians will tell you with a straight face that if someone had broadcast a television show and didn't want it recorded with a VCR, that the state would intervene on their behalf to stop the recording on the VCR because it's their moral right to do so. They have a strong lending right, so strong, in fact, that they send checks to foreign authors. I'm a member of the Science Fiction Writers of America, and every year we get about $70,000 from the Swedish government for the lending of American science fiction novels in Sweden. It's hard, as a utilitarian proposition, which is how the Americans think of copyright, it's hard to imagine what good this does. There are no Americans who wrote extra books this year because the Swedes sent our trade association $70,000, but certainly we're not sending it back. And in France, you have an even stronger moral rights culture that extends, in some court cases, right down to painters objecting to which wall their paintings were being hung on after they had been sold, and demanding that they be moved to other walls and out of proximity to painters whom they did not consider their equal. Each of these can be thought of as an experiment in how best to conduct your intellectual life, how best to conduct your information policy. And each of these has proven a source of empirical evidence about what works and what doesn't where. But the march of globalization has eliminated our capacity to test these propositions because they're being imposed by fiat through trade agreements and harmonized around the world through agreements like the TRIPS, which is the copyright, patent, and trademark provisions in the WTO, and through WIPO treaties. WIPO is the UN agency responsible for copyright and related treaties. And two particular treaties that have come into play in the internet era are the WIPO Copyright Treaty and the WIPO Performer and Photograms Treaty. Or maybe it's Photogram and Performer. I always get that mixed up. And these agreements set a minimum on the privileges that the public must extend to rights holders and that the public purse must pay to police. But they set no minimum on the rights that are given back to the public in return for this. So every country in the world has its own set of limitations on copyright. And those are not harmonized. So those who would share information or cooperate on information goods around the world find themselves having to navigate a minefield, frequently unnavigable, in order to conduct intellectual life across borders. For example, in many countries, there's a statutory limitation on the rights of authors that forbids them from enjoining people who serve blind people from turning their books into editions accessible by the blind. So, for example, a Braille edition or an audio edition. But in South Africa, in some countries, this is not allowed. And so someone who prepares an edition in South Africa, say by reading it aloud, finds themselves breaking the law. And of course today, you have great global collaborative efforts. My favorite example being the distributed proofreader project, which is part of Project Gutenberg. Project Gutenberg digitizes public domain books. They were doing it long before Google Book Search was a gleam in a Sergey Brin's eye. And what they do is scan these books, turn out digital pages that are then converted laboriously to text, often with many errors that are introduced by this conversion process, the so-called optical character recognition process. And then individuals around the world will check out a single page and spend 5 minutes checking it for typos and then check it back in. And that five-minute effort adds up one page after another to build a library that encompasses thousands of volumes, all of them cleaned up from this machine process. But these people, depending on where they live, may find themselves working on works that they believe to be in the public domain, but are in fact still in copyright, or doing something that they believe is permitted by fair use or fair dealing, but isn't in their local jurisdiction. And there really aren't enough lawyer hours remaining between now and the heat death of the universe to advise every person who would check out a page of text and find its typos and check it back in again to these public service programs and tell them whether or not they're violating the law. Likewise, in the UK, there's no exemption for parody. And my friends who are legal scholars in European law tell me that, in fact, every search engine is likely illegal in Europe. And now we have questions about whether Google has the right to index books. This was the subject, of course, of a celebrated and notorious legal decision in the United States, or settled legal settlement, rather, in the United States, and there was never a decision. But the question arose when Google began scanning books both in copyright and out, and creating an index of them that would allow you to go to Google and, just like you do with web pages, enter a few words and find all the books that those words appear in, and to view a few sentences that match those words, just the same way that you would go and search for a phrase that appears on the web, and it will show you a few lines from those web pages. You can click through to see the pages. Google would let you view that one page, but no more. A small group of authors called the Authors Guild objected to this. They said that making a copy of a page in order to produce an index of it was a violation of the author's exclusive right to control copying and not fair use or fair dealing anywhere, and that Google was in fact engaged in a massive act of what amounted to piracy. What the Authors Guild was never able to adequately explain is why this would be unlawful for Google to do in respect of books, but not in respect of the millions and billions of copyrighted works that we call web pages. For all of those have authors, and most of those are in copyright, and those web pages that are in copyright are snaffled up by Google by their billions, and not just by Google, but by every search engine from AltaVista forward, and turned into indices, and then served out to web searchers who would like to find out which pages are where on the internet. We don't know whether or not this is lawful. We don't know where it's lawful. And if it's lawful in one country, we don't know that it's lawful anywhere else, because the exemptions to copyright are different in every country, whereas the rights that are given to authors have a minimum threshold in every country. So this is where the public cost begins in earnest, because the network is fundamentally a copying machine. And copying will never, ever get harder from here on in. Hard drives aren't going to get bulkier and less capacious and more expensive. Networks aren't going to get slower and harder to use. Our general fluency with networks is not going to decline, and computers aren't going to get slower. If any of these things happen, it would likely be as a marker of some terrible disaster that befell the planet. It wouldn't be because the natural order of technology was to march forward and decide, in fact, what we need are bigger, less capacious hard drives that cost more. It is inconceivable to me, even with my wildest futurist hat on, that we would voluntarily decide to make storage more expensive or networks slower. So copyright reifies copying as an extraordinary act. It dates back to a period in which making a copy of a copyrighted work was indeed extraordinary. First, because copyrighted works were in the minority. In many places, works only entered copyright when the author took an affirmative step. The author would send a copy to their national library and file a request with their copyright office asking for a copyright. And as countries around the world have acceded to the Berne Convention, this is something that was conceived of by Victor Hugo and later incorporated into things like the WIPO Copyright Treaty, as countries around, or rather the WTO, as countries around the world have acceded to Berne, the need for this formality for a copyright has eroded one country after another, such that now every work of any creativity is in copyright from the instant it's fixed, from your kid's menu doodles at dinner, all the way up to the speech whose notes I'm reading from. So, first, it was rare that works were in copyright at all. And second, it was rare that the average individual had the capacity to replicate them in a way that was likely to attract the interest of a copyright owner. Making a copy of a phonogram meant that you owned a record press. Making a copy of a film meant that you owned a film lab. Making a copy of a sound recording meant that you owned a sound lab. Today, copying is something that takes place a million times before breakfast. If you think of the number of copies that are made when you sit down at your keyboard and click your mouse and actually start to talk to someone who knows a little about engineering, you'll soon run out of fingers to copy, to count them. You know, there's the copy that's made in your keyboard buffer, and then the copy that's made in your network buffer, and then the copy that's made in the graphics buffer, and then the copy that's made of the web proxy, and the copy that's made of the switch, and the copy that's made of the server, and the copy that's made coming back, and the copy that's stored in your cache, and so on, and so on, and so on, and so on. So, what was once a body of law that regulated the conduct of large industrial players in respect of a small number of works has now become the dominant mechanism by which we regulate all of our interactions over the network. This law wasn't designed to carry that kind of freight. It wasn't designed to be interpreted by lay people. Some would argue that it's impossible to be correctly interpreted by legal scholars. Pam Samuelson, who's at the University of Berkeley at the Samuel Center program, also at GWU in DC, who's one of America's great copyright scholars, recently wrote a paper in which she reviewed the revisions to 17 U.S.C., the American Copyright Statute, and concluded that it couldn't be reconciled, that no matter how carefully you read it, there were just things in it that didn't make sense, that contradicted itself, that no one could correctly apply American copyright law because it had become such a crufted over piece of legal code as it had been patched and revised and repatched as it was stretched to cover more and more of what we do on our daily round that it had ceased to be meaningful at all and becomes buggy as an old copy of Windows 98. So, breathing and conversing trigger copyright law today. And I'd like you to think for a moment about what we do on our networks. So I have a 19-month-old daughter in London. And as 19-month-olds do, she gets a lot of strange ailments. And every now and again, she does things like break out in pink polka dots. Now, we are fortunate to live in London, which is one of the great cities of the world, but it has some unfortunate sides, too. One is that there are a number of people who have been taken in by junk science and think that inoculating their children is a bad idea. So we have live measles in Hackney. My daughter's too young to get a measles injection. So when she breaks out in pink polka dots, we worry a lot. Lucky for us, we have access to the internet through which we reassure ourselves using the National Health Service's excellent home diagnosis protocol that helps you find out whether your kid has merely got an all-over rash or whether you need to rush to the hospital right now. Social connectivity. Well, I've been an expatriate from Canada for 10 years. And yet the way I stay in contact with my family and with my friends all around the world is over the network. My daughter knows her grandparents through Skype and through video conferencing and her cousin in Toronto. I made contact with a distant cousin who we didn't even know existed, Nadia Dokhtarovich, who lives in Montevideo, Uruguay, who's the daughter of my grandfather's half-brother, whom he lost contact with during World War II. And we're now in regular correspondence in my horrible broken Spanish and her very enthusiastic English. Education. Well, I'm a visiting scholar at Open University in Milton Keynes in the UK, and also a visiting lecturer at the University of Waterloo here in Ontario, an institution that I was privileged to drop out of in 1992. I spend very little time on either campus, and yet I have an active group of students whom I'm closely in contact with, and this is hardly unique. We are all of us who are engaged in education, increasingly using the network to collaborate, to learn, and to teach. and political engagement. Here in Canada, we've just concluded a wide-scale consultation on copyright, more on that later, through which thousands of Canadians expressed themselves using the network to talk about the network. Those of you who participated in the last American election will know that the president who was elected raised much of his funding and secured much of his grassroots support through the use of the network. It's how we find our employment. Is there anyone in this room who could do their job without access to the network? No hands are going up. And it's how we find love. I'm married to a British woman whom I met in Helsinki and whom I conducted a long-distance affair with from San Francisco for some time before I moved over to the United Kingdom. And it's the single wire that delivers freedom of press, freedom of assembly, and freedom of speech. And every one of these activities involves copying. And every one of these activities has become part of the regulatory purview of copyright. But copyright continues to be made as though it were a matter of mere self-regulation among industrial giants, as though the public had no interest in its outcome. So, for example, here in Canada, several parliaments ago, which is to say about 8 months ago, the woman who was likely to be writing the next copyright bill and running the next ministry through which it would fall, Sam Bulte, went out and raised basically the legal limit for her funding from the copyright industries and patent industries, something that was relatively unheard of in Canadian law. And who, when was asked to take a pledge to not assume any regulatory position in which she would regulate people who had been substantial campaign funders, to essentially exempt herself from obvious conflicts of interest, she instead flew off the handle at a community meeting and shouted that she would not be bullied by user rights zealots and Electronic Frontier Foundation members. And then at the World Intellectual Property Organization, where there were treaty work underway to establish a new layer of copyrights or pseudo-copyrights over broadcasts and over webcasts, there was almost no public involvement right up to the last moment when a few NGOs discovered that it was underway, and where those NGOs found themselves greatly thwarted by not just by the entertainment industry and its representatives, but also by the formal structure of WIPO. For example, the handouts that were delivered from the public interest non-governmental organizations were stolen away from the literature tables and then later turned up behind a pot of plants in the toilets. And when the activist non-governmental organizations complained to the secretariat, they were told that they were ungrateful and that if this kind of thing continued, that the secretariat would simply ban all literature handouts. And she actually took an affirmative step in that direction by no longer subsidizing copying. So when the Motion Picture Association and Pharma were doing their copying at WIPO, that was done by the WIPO photocopy room. But afterwards, NGOs had to find themselves in copy shops. And of course, the MPA and Pharma and other big rights holder groups had offices and PAs, whereas the public interest groups were staying in youth hostels and trying to find copy shops that were open early enough to get our copies in. Nevertheless, we use technology in a way that I think absolutely baffled and ultimately defeated the people who were interested in making this treaty happen, this broadcasting treaty. The first thing we did when we got there was we started to write down what was being said. This isn't really normally thought of as a radical act, but it turned out to be, partly because of how we conducted it. So my colleague, Wendy Seltzer, who's just gone to, I think, the University of Washington in Seattle to research patents, fired up a wireless network on her laptop, not connected to the internet. There really wasn't internet connectivity until much later at WIPO. I have a rule of thumb that anytime people gather to discuss internet regulation and don't provide an internet connection, they're not there to help the internet. She fired up a little wireless network, and we collaborated to take notes on what was being said. Now, those of you who've been in the diplomatic corps and have been through treaty negotiations will be familiar with the style of conversation or discourse at treaty negotiations. It's very difficult for a layperson to understand. So they rise and say, "Mr. Secretary, as I take my feet here for the 17th session of the Standing Committee on Copyright and Related Rights, I would like to express my confidence in you, our chair, the secretary, the good works you do, and congratulate you on being reappointed." And And I would like to say that on behalf of my delegation, that we are in support of Clause W, but would like to reserve comment on Clause X. And from this, you know, new arrivals were meant to try and sort of figure out what's going on. This turned out to be difficult. So we started to take copious notes. And because we could all collaborate over this network connection, we had a piece of software called SubEthaEdit that allowed several of us to take notes at the same time. One of us would be typing what was being said. One of us would be cleaning up typos. One of us would be writing interpretation in square brackets. I think this means this. We were able to produce a fairly accurate and certainly very timely version of what was going on at White Level. And moreover, we were able to publish it twice a day, at breakfast and at lunch. And a funny thing started to happen. The public started to find out what was going on at the United Nations as a negotiation was underway to determine the future of the shape of the networks that they used every day. And they started to call up their Catholics and their representatives to either lionize them or excoriate them for what had happened that day. Now, this was in contrast to the normal note-taking process at WIGO, which involved the secretariat preparing a kind of verbatim version of what had been said, but subsequently sending it around to everyone who was quoted to give them the opportunity to correct the record, which included removing things that they wished they hadn't said, and so on. And there wasn't any commentary to explain it to a layperson, and it came out sort of 6 months afterwards. And so it was very hard to make this part of, you know, to bring the public into the room. So we started to have delegations come up to us at the lunch break and say, I have just heard from my capital that they've heard from some very important people in the IT industry that they read on something called a Slashdot that they're very happy with what we've done. It's the first time anyone's ever said that to us. I think you had something to do with it. It was very funny. It was very gratifying, and it really changed the caliber of the negotiations very quickly. Partly because a lot of the input that delegations from poorer nations got was rather one-sided. And you can imagine, say you're a sub-Saharan African nation, and you send a delegation to Geneva, it will be a small delegation, 4 people, 6 people, something like that. And they will likely be experts not on communications policy, but on things like agriculture or children's health, these being very pressing issues in sub-Saharan Africa. Now, you still have to go to the White House meetings, and you rely on experts to tell you what's going on, and those experts were largely people from the entertainment industry, the pharmaceutical lobby, and so on. And their input wasn't always very balanced. One point, I had intervened in the morning, and a delegation from a sub-Saharan African nation came up to me and said, it's very easy for you from an American NGO to talk about what will happen with your broadcast signals, because obviously everything of value in the United States that's broadcast has encryption on it. It can't be viewed with regular antenna. You need to buy some licensed equipment that limits what you can do with it. And I said, oh, no, that's not true. And he said, well, maybe you don't agree that that's the best stuff. And I said, no, you don't understand. The Federal Communications Commission, as a matter of policy, prohibits using encryption on free-to-air broadcasts. That's why we call them free-to-air. He said, oh dear, I'll have to discuss this with Mr. So-and-so. And I asked my rabbi there, the man from the group that's now called Knowledge Ecology International, Jamie Love. I said, who's Mr. So-and-so? And he said, oh, that's the representative from the American National Association of Broadcasters. He's been touring in sub-Saharan Africa explaining how American broadcasting works to them. So this is the caliber of expert input that they relied upon. And with a new set of voices in the room, we were able to really change it. But until then, all of the treaty making that had happened on the global scale in these multilateral UN treaties had taken place without any public interest input. And wherever we attempted to include it, we found ourselves not very welcome, it must be said. And of course, that's a macrocosm for things that happen in the microcosm all the time. You may remember that former Industry Minister Jim Prentice took 2 cracks at reforming Canadian copyright law, but in his consultations refused to talk with Canadian stakeholders. He only would talk to trade organizations that represented multinational US-based entertainment groups, not Canadian record labels, not Canadian archivists, not Canadian network operators, and certainly not the Canadian public. These are often made without regard to the public interest. So in the United Kingdom, where I live, we recently had a rather in-depth look at copyright and patent policy undertaken through the exchequer of the Treasury, through economists. This was a radical departure from the normal mechanism for investigating copyright, which is to usually investigate it through culture ministry. So the economists looked at how much copyright was good and when more copyright was better, and concluded that adding more copyright, especially retrospective copyright, which has been the norm in North America, where when copyright is extended, it's given backwards to people who've already created work. So when the term goes from 50 to 70 year, life plus 50 to life plus 70 years, everyone who's already created work gets those extra 20 years. And the Exchequer concluded that this actually delivered almost no money to creators' pockets, and certainly incentivized the creation of no new works. I mean, you could give Hemingway 1,000 years of copyright, and a truncheon of which he was personally allowed to beat up anyone who infringed it, and Hemingway wouldn't write any more books. Hemingway's dead. So they concluded not only that this wouldn't incentivize the creation of more works, but also that it would cause a drug on the journal society, that it would actually undermine the economy for creative works, and that it would run contrary to the public interest. In this, they repeated similar findings in other areas. The European Commission, for example, investigated the European right to exclusive access to factual databases, things like phone books. And in Europe for 25-some years, they've had a regime through which phone books and other non-original databases of facts could be owned, whereas in the United States, they have no such comparable right. And they concluded, having investigated these two regimes, that the reason the U.S. Industry had grown 25-fold and the European industry had stagnated was that this was, in fact, bad policy, that even though you might incentivize a few more investors who would be assured by the fact that they would have an exclusive right to the fruit of their investment, that was completely annihilated by the lack of competition and what it would spur people to. And nevertheless, in both the EU and in the UK, we threw that research out and said, hang the public interest. Keith Richards says he wants more copyright. And it's made without regard to evidence. So in many regimes, there is a prohibition on circumvention of digital rights management technology. This is stuff that's meant to control your access and further use of copyrighted works, or indeed any work. So if you've ever tried to loan a friend a song you bought from the iTunes store, or if you've ever tried to back up a DVD, or if you've ever tried to play a game without having the CD handy, you've encountered some kind of digital rights management or copy prevention software. Now, copy prevention software is never really preventing a copy. No one can point to a version of the software that's ever really worked to do its job. And there's no reason to believe that it ever will. Copy prevention software relies on the idea that I can deliver to you an encrypted work that is a work that's been scrambled, and then hide the key that descrambles the work in your device, and then count on the idea that you will never get access to that key without my permission. And it furthermore relies on the idea that no one else will do this either, and having cracked the work, put the work online. And in practical experience, what we find is that hiding a key in a device that you then give to the person who you hope won't find the key doesn't work very well. You know, my favorite example of this is what happened with three successive generations of DVDs. The first generation DVD was broken by a young man whom the Norwegians called DVD Jan Leif Johansen, who was 15 when he extracted the keys for DVDs with some of his friends, I think they were Germans, also 15 years old. And they did a kind of before breakfast for kicks. You know, this was the work of years, millions of dollars spent, best engineering minds in the world, but they couldn't make a bit that couldn't be copied, because as the cryptographer and computer scientist Bruce Schneier says, making bits harder to copy is like making water less wet. So they extracted it. It turned out that the program necessary to break the encryption on a DVD was so small you could fit it on a t-shirt. And they, in fact, did print out t-shirts. Jan was sued in Norway, and they tried to figure out what to sue him for, because they didn't have an anti-circumvention law on the books yet. They do now. And what they ended up suing him for was intrusion into a computer system. And when the record industry was asked, or the video industry was asked, whose computer system he'd intruded upon, they said, well, his own. Jan eventually prevailed. Subsequent to this, new versions, even more fiendishly clever than DVD-CSS, were invented. One was called HD-DVD. You'll remember it as the now defunct DRM system for high-definition DVDs. A young man named Muselik 64, a cracker so fearsome he named himself after a breakfast cereal, bought one of these DVDs and found he couldn't play it. He couldn't play it because he was using a free and open operating system called Linux. And Linux is designed to be modified by its users. And digital rights management always carries as a condition that it not be modifiable by its users. Because, of course, if you design a system whereby, say, the National Library can loan out a book, but while it's loaned out, no one else can borrow it, then someone could just trivially, if the software were modifiable by the user, reach in and say, rather than make one copy loanable, make 1 million or 1 billion copies loanable. The copy prevention rolls out the window. So sat down to see if he could figure out how to get this DVD to play on Linux. And he could. Took him a morning. He found out where the keys were. He published them on the internet. It was a 128-bit number. Again, fits on the t-shirt. And he distributed the number far and wide. The licensing authority that controls DVD-HD asserted that he violated their copyright by publishing this number. Now, copyright normally adheres to creative works. This was a random number. Copyright does not adhere to random numbers. Then they tried to assert that it was a trade secret, at which point it was on something like 12 million web pages. A number that's on 12 million web pages is not a secret. So they failed, and the number was widespread. But anyways, the standard was failing in the marketplace, and it didn't last. What it was replaced with was Blu-ray, which, of course, you all know. And someone wrote to me, Muselik 64, and said, I don't have a DVD-HD player. I have a Blu-ray player, but I have the same problem as you. I have some Windows machines that it runs on, but it won't run on my Linux machine. Can you help me out? And he said, well, you know, I don't own a Blu-ray player. I've never seen a Blu-ray player. I've never touched a Blu-ray player, but yeah, I think I can help you out. Why don't you just send me a dump of everything that's in your RAM, your memory, while you're watching a DVD? Any reason that somewhere in that memory would be the key. So there's a couple of gigabytes of RAM compressed down, emailed to Muselik 64 in his readout, wherever that happens to be. And he sits down, and he looks at bits 1 through 128 and checks to see if they decrypt the video. They don't. Then he looks at 2 through 130. Then he looks at 3 through 131, and so on. About an hour later, he'd extracted the keys to Blu-ray. Mycroft Holmes, sitting in his cellar, solving crime without ever venturing forth, he had found the solution. And yet, we continue to make DRM protection laws, laws that protect DRM and the vendors, as though we will somehow find a DRM that works, even though the only engineers who say that such a thing is possible work for DRM companies. That everyone who's involved in this on the other side, as an academic or scholar or security expert, says, this stuff doesn't exist and won't exist. You can't give the attacker the keys, because then the attacker will have the keys. We make it without regard to evidence on subjects like the automatic detection of copyright infringement. So, for example, Viacom and several other television and film companies brought suit against YouTube, Google, asserting that Google could automatically detect whether a video that was uploaded infringed upon copyright and could automatically interdict this without need for them going to the website, finding videos that have been infringed and sending them a letter of complaint. And that they just weren't doing it because they were making too much money hosting this infringing material. They insisted that it was possible to automatically detect copyright infringement. Now this is quite an idea, and one that most computer scientists, again, find wildly improbable. Take a much easier to define and easier to solve domain problem, like finding and detecting spam. And one of my favorite things to do at technical conferences is say, who in this room has written a spam filter? A bunch of hands go up, and I say, did any of them work? And all the hands go down. Spam is infinitely easier to detect than copyright infringement. It's all text. You can tell copyright infringement could literally be anything. Since everything is copyrighted from the moment you fix it, if there's a picture of someone's kid's napkin doodle, that could be a copyright infringement too. And most importantly, the people who the spam filter is sitting upstream of want the spam filter to help them, whereas the people who are sitting downstream from the copyright filter don't want it to help. They're actively trying to foil you. We never built a decent spam filter. Even the much-vaunted PhD factory that is Google has never built an adequate spam filter. And the reason we've never built an adequate spam filter is because you would have to solve the hard artificial intelligence problem in order to do this. And if you did, you would have far more interesting things to do with your business than find spam or copyright, like taking over the world. So we talk endlessly about the information economy, the information society. In 1999, we widely enacted the WTO and watched every hard goods industry move to cheaper labor pools, and we assured ourselves that information jobs would replace manufacturing jobs that were leaving our shores. And yet, we continue to treat the internet as a fitting political football in the bid to ensure windfall profits for the entertainment industry. So take, for example, the notion of three strikes. Depending on where you are, this is sometimes called graduated response. In France, it's called hadouken. And at WIPO, when they first flooded it, it was called notice and termination. This is a self-help measure. And what it says in one form or another is that if you are accused three times of infringing upon copyright, someone will come along and cut off your internet access. And so this has been a feature in proposals here in Canada, in the United States, internationally. Now, this is intended as a self-help measure, and we have other self-help measures in copyright enforcement. The most famous is something called notice and takedown. The idea was that if you host internet materials, web pages or what have you, your users might upload something that's infringing, a photograph, a game, a video, a song, and that you as the host, under the normal course of copyright law, might find yourself liable for that infringement. It depends. It's not really clear whether or not you would or wouldn't be prior to the notice and takedown regime. But what notice and takedown says is you are not liable for that infringement if you undertake to expeditiously remove anything that is infringing upon notice of the infringement. Okay, so you are, the bargain goes like this. You've got a customer, the customer has a web page. A rights holder sends you an email. The email says that web page infringes my copyright. Now, if you look at that web page and you say, there's no way that it infringes anyone's copyright. It's a picture of my customer's kid. You have the choice of saying, go pound sand. It doesn't infringe copyright. But if you're wrong and a lawsuit is brought, you can be held liable for damages in the United States of $150,000 civilly and $250,000 criminally for every act. So this could really run into serious money, even these days when a million is more than a million. This is practically what this has done. It's meant that every ISP that receives one of these notices automatically takes the material down. Again, they think it's not worth asking a lawyer whether or not they should. The total profits that they're likely to receive from any given customer will be completely wiped out by the cost of asking a lawyer whether they should keep that person as a customer. And again, when we've done little tests, we've seen that this has happened. My favorite, there's some very mischievous people at the Oxford Internet Institute who put copies of John Stuart Mill's On Liberty on various web servers and then sent letters on behalf of John Stuart Mill to the hosting companies and found universally that they were willing to remove it. This is extremely open to abuse, in other words. But it's not just open to abuse, it's also open to sloppy exercise. So we have seen termination or takedown notices served, for example, on colleges that were unlucky enough to have a professor whose surname, Usher, was the same as a famous rock musician, and who put up his lectures with titles like Usher.mp3. The rights holder didn't bother to verify that this infringed their copyright. They kind of outsourced that verification, that externality, that cost to the university network operators. And this is not an isolated incident. We find it again and again, these kinds of spurious takedown notices. We've also seen a lot of abuse. The Church of Scientology used notice and takedown routinely to attack its critics and to assert that in criticizing them and quoting their materials as part of that criticism, they infringed the Scientologist's copyright, and they used it to silence that debate. Likewise, another self-help measure, streamlined litigation, which isn't enshrined really in law, but has instead become part of practice, where rights holder organizations recruit third parties to sue en masse, ultimately tens of thousands of people, through a kind of boiler room operation in which you get a phone call that says, you're infringing our copyright, our client's copyright, for less than it will cost you to talk to a lawyer, we will clear you of that infringement. These people are paid in bulk. The more people they get settlements out of, the better. They're a little like a collection agency. And they've gone after such varied individuals as dead people, small children, people who don't own computers, and at one point, a sweet old grandmother who was accused of downloading a lot of gangster rap in Florida. They accused a laser printer of downloading a copy of Indiana Jones. It's been capriciously exercised. We've seen Diebold, the voting machine company, use notice and takedown to try and silence people who had found and circulated an internal whistleblower memo asserting that Diebold knew and participated in what amounted to electoral fraud through its voting machines. We have a really awful example. There's a student at Swarthmore who maintained a free software project called Flatlam. Flatlam was a search engine. What it did is it crawled your LAN, hence Flatland, your local area network, and found all the open file SharePoints and indexed them, the way that Google crawls the web, finds all the HTTP share, the web SharePoints, and indexes their contents. Now, on campuses, you often find PowerPoints of lectures, notes, old exams, MP3s of lectures, videos of lectures, student work, and so on. But of course, it being a campus, you also find lots of music, videos, games, and so on. To some nicety, every student on campus is a copyright infringer. I think everybody, to some nicety, is probably a copyright infringer. When I gave this talk at Disney, I said, is there anyone in this room who isn't a copyright infringer? And none of the lawyers put their hands up, but a couple of the engineers started to inch their hands up, not really sure whether what they did infringed on copyright or not, and the lawyers looked over and went, put your hand. Now, this student, because he was a copyright infringer, because the potential liability went to the zillions, found himself in a very weak negotiating position. And when the record industry targeted him because the software that he used was used to infringe copyright, was used to find music on other campuses, now they knew that the software wasn't illegal and they would never successfully sue him for maintaining it, but they could successfully sue him for downloading music. Being an American teenager, he was guaranteed to be downloading music. And as part of the settlement, they demanded that he change majors, that he walk away from computer science and change majors. Now, he did, in fact, this did give him a little bit of negotiating power. That negotiating power was that this so outraged decency and common sense that when we publicized it through the Electronic Frontier Foundation, they were forced to rescind this demand. So self-help has historically been an invitation to vigilantism and an arrogation of the state's responsibility to due process. Yet, we're proposing to extend it beyond censoring publication, and we're proposing to extend it to access to the net itself. Think of what you do on the network. Think of that list that I just enumerated, your job, your health, your love, your family, your civic engagement, your creativity, even down to the trivial. In many places, the best or only way to stop your post when you go on holiday or to renew your magazine subscriptions is in using the network. All of this can be taken away without proof of wrongdoing on the mere assertion of infringement. Three strikes and you're out. And not only that, but can be taken away from everyone in your household in a form of collective punishment that, again, justice historically has recoiled from. Justice has usually viewed the idea of punishing people who are near to someone who has broken some law as unjust. But in my household, we have 9 people who depend on our network connections. If one of us is accused 3 times of infringement, all 9 of us would lose our connection if 3 strikes became the law. And there is a proposal now in the UK to make it a law. And there's no reason to believe that this will stop or slow copying, because, of course, infringers, dedicated infringers, have access to cryptography through which they can prevent detection of their infringement. And moreover, they have access to hard drives, which are getting smaller and more capacious every day. When I taught through my Fulbright at the University of Southern California, I had a delightful group of undergraduates. And practically every one of them was a musician, and they loved to get together for jam sessions, a couple of cases of beer, some amps, some guitars, and some hard drives. And while they were playing, they would just synchronize terabytes of information. No matter what you do to the network, you won't stop hard drive parties. They're going to get faster and easier, not slower. So we're all copyists, and all of us become vulnerable, like that student in Swarthmore, to the capricious exercise of this self-help measure. To give you an idea of how unjust this is, imagine if it were reciprocal. Imagine if, when Universal Music filed three erroneous notice and termination notices, as they inevitably will, we went around to every Universal office in the world with a set of bolt cutters and disconnected them from the internet and made them the record label that ran on faxes from now on. It would be a corporate death penalty, because taking a corporation out of the information society is ending a corporation. Taking an individual, a free person, out of the information society is really a form of exile in the 21st century. There's no proportionality. Imagine if publishers were given letters of marque through which they could come to your house and take away your books if you were accused of being naughty with a photocopier three times. Three Strikes is being pushed on multiple fronts. In the US, Canada, Europe, and the other rich countries, it's being proposed through a secret treaty negotiation called ACTA, the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement. Now, I say it's a secret because the text of the treaty has not been released. There was a FOIA request, a Freedom of Information Act request, in the United States for the Obama regime, who denied it, saying that the text of this treaty was a matter of national security. But what we do know about this treaty, we've learned through leaks, because it's not a very good secret. In the U.S., the Trade Department has a list of some 300 or 400 advisors, including executives from breweries, fertilizer executives, paint executives, and so on, who are all allowed to look at this treaty. And they've leaked it like a sieve. So we've seen various drafts of it. The Obama administration released memos about it, and so on. And we know that it includes a three strikes regime. We know that it also includes a duty for border police to police copyright on hard drives, to start to check data as it crosses borders and on physical containers to see whether it infringes. And when this first came to light, people on my side of this fight said, well, this means they're going to have to start searching your iPods. And the memo that the Obama administration released about it saying, no, you don't need to worry, they said, well, it won't involve searching iPods, because anything that is not that wouldn't allow a substantial act of infringement will be exempt. Well, I don't know about you, but I expect my iPod to hold every song ever recorded in about 5 years. That's the trajectory solid-state storage is on. I don't know how you could consider any of the data devices that we carry around to be less than significant. I mean, certainly, the Christmas ornament I was given last year is a premium at a grocery store which held about 200 songs, and which was so cheap it could essentially be given away free like a Happy Meal toy, qualifies as capable of a substantial act of infringement. I could definitely put about 3,000 or 4,000 books on it. We've also seen this just enacted in the EU, in France, under the Hadopi banner. After 3 or 4 attempts to enact it in law, and after the European Courts of Justice and the High French Court said that this violated human rights norms, to take away your internet access without a judiciary, Sarkozy basically created a kangaroo court through which you would have a 2 to 5 minute opportunity to defend yourself before your network connection was taken away from you. And this is a proposal across the EU. There's some indication that it may sneak into the next Canadian copyright bill. And we have to ask ourselves, why does all this stuff take place in secret? Why does it take place out of the public eye? I may flatter myself, but I think that the reason that this isn't being undertaken at the UN, and this was something that was in the Obama administration's memo, is that rights holder groups no longer believe that they can get what they want out of the UN, because public interest groups now attend those meetings and disclose the substance of their negotiations. Hence the secrecy of Bill C-60 and Bill C-61. What we discover when we ask the public whether or not we want our information lives conducted on this basis is that the public overwhelmingly doesn't. We like the idea of artists getting paid, we like the idea of a fair and just society, but we don't like the idea of accusation being a basis to bankrupt our children, or to enact criminal sanctions or civil sanctions, or to take away our network access. Indeed, the Canadian consultation that's just ended shows overwhelming national support for a more liberal copyright regime, and no substantial support for the kind of copyright regime that was proposed the last two times around when we tried to get a copyright bill passed. Now, I'm a rights holder. That's what I do for a living. I write all day long. It's actually one of the great luxuries in my life that I sit in a room and write all day long. It's the kind of thing I've dreamt of doing all my life. And copyright law is critical to how I make my living. And for me, the worst aspect of all of this is that it alienates the public from copyright law. When you hand the public a license agreement that starts with, by reading this document, you agree to the following. You know, I'm allowed to come over to your house and wear your underwear and clean up your fridge and make some long-distance phone calls and punch your grandmother, and this can all be changed without notice, and by standing there shouting, no, 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 I don't agree, you have agreed. And then we say, well, actually, you don't need to worry about all that crazy stuff. You just have to worry about these clauses. That's just there in case we ever need it. What we essentially say is that it's meaningless. It can't be interpreted. The stuff that's in the copyright agreement isn't really an agreement at all. We do great violence to the idea of agreement when we say this about the agreements. Do we really want people to believe that they don't need to pay attention to copyright notices? We continue to create DRM even though no customer of mine ever woke up and said, I wish there was a way I could do less with my books. Maybe Adobe's added some DRM to ebooks. If you buy a copy of The Lion King, as I did for my 19-month-old, the deluxe edition that cost £35, you'll find yourself sitting through 25 minutes of business model before the movie starts. If you steal your copy, you don't get any of that. If you bought Sony BMG Music 2 years ago when they were caught putting rootkits, these are malicious software that are used by hackers to take control of your computer, they were caught putting rootkits on millions of CDs. They compromised hundreds of American military and government networks. You got an infection on your computer, one that was extremely hard to remove. If you stole that CD by downloading it without permission, without paying for it, you've got no such infection. What this has the net effect of doing is convincing people that copyright law is for suckers, and buying stuff is something that people who are not in the know do. And it's not necessary, because there are plenty of artists thriving in the digital era, whether it's the Bare Naked Ladies or Madonna, who's moved from a record label to a concert promoter, because the more copies there are of Madonna's work, the more her concert tickets are worth. Or Jonathan Coulton, the nerd bard, who set out to write a song a week for 52 weeks and release them for free on the internet, and now finds himself touring and getting stadium shows. Or whether it's filmmakers like Nina Paley, Michael Moore, or Robert Greenwald, who've embraced copying of their works. Or writers. My last book, Little Brother, has been 9,000 hardcovers in print in the U.S., 16 foreign editions in print are forthcoming, New York Times bestseller, film rights sold, stage rights sold, comic rights under negotiation, and so on and so forth. It was available as a free download the day it came out in stores with a license that encouraged and permitted remixing, including translations. And many of the translations I sold were into markets where non-commercial fan translations already existed. So I like Hollywood. I don't want you to get the impression that I don't like it. I like watching the robots and the buildings at each other as much as the next guy. My Fulbright was at USC. My local cinemas were the Cinerama Dome and Grauman's Chinese. I was in heaven while I was there. But the entertainment industry has framed this as them or us. The head of Universal says that the internet has been a net negative for society. Ultimately, I don't care if it's good for the entertainment industry or not. We can argue all day long about whether it's good, whether artists can or can't survive in an era in which copying takes place. I don't care even if it turns out that they're right with the need for DRM. I still choose no DRM because it won't work. And because it builds the architecture of control into the information society. I'm a science fiction writer. I write books. So, of course, I go to see science fiction movies so that I can be angry at the writers who make more money than I do, but write dumber science than I do. So a fixture in science fiction movies is the rocket ship with the self-destruct button. Someone inevitably hits the self-destruct button and the self-destruct timer starts counting down. I always think to myself, wouldn't this be a better rocket ship if it wasn't designed to explode? And when I hear someone saying we need to design computers so that they can keep secrets from their users so that policy can be enforced against them without their knowledge or permission, I say to myself, wouldn't this be a more secure computer, a more fitting vehicle with which to ride into the information age, if it were designed never to keep secrets from its owner, if it were designed never to allow remote policy to be set against its owner without their permission or knowledge? I still say we need liberal copyright, even if they're right about it being us or them. I don't think they are right. John Philip Sousa in the early 1900s predicted that if the phonogram were allowed to continue, that humanity would lose its voice boxes as we lost our tails when they came down out of the trees. And he was extremely wrong, although he was an early advocate of the still controversial in some quarters theory of natural selection. I do give him points for that. Jack Valenti in 1982, I beg your pardon, said that the VCR is to the American film industry as the Boston Strangler is to a woman home alone. He was completely wrong. But even if they're right this time around, I still choose us. Because choosing them means legislating in secret. It means wiretapping the network. It means undermining the fundamental principles of justice and due process. We have universal access to all human knowledge in our grasp. We have access to tools and communities and ideas. The internet makes it cheaper and easier to collaborate and work together and solve our problems than it has ever been in all of human history. And that's worth more than 100 film industries or 1,000 record industries.